In this final segment, I'm going to take a few passages out of the book Roger Williams, The Church and the State by Edmund S. Morgan. Roger Williams was an advocate for the total separation of the church and state. He lived during the Protestant Church in England to Massachusetts, and was part of the government or the philosophical underpinnings of the government in the 17th century. And he reveals separation, his views, which were highly controversial, between the church and the state, and the right relation of the two. He's very decisive difference in the way we interpret the earliest decades of our history. So I highly suggest you read this book. It's very insightful because he comes up against the prevailing position, even of Reformation theology, which I just covered now. He supported rulers against papal interference, which the Puritans stressed that the church must not interfere with the state. The state, this is page 65, the church and state in Massachusetts, was concerned with the spiritual and temporal welfare of all people within its bound and was endowed with coercive temporal powers. The church was concerned solely with the spiritual welfare of its own members and was endowed with non-coercive spiritual powers. To allow a clergyman to do the work of princes was to set him on the road to Rome. The Pope is the Antichrist because, being an ecclesiastical officer, he does in the height of the pride of his heart may claim unto and usurp the supremacy of kings, civil rulers, and civil rulers of the earth. The distinction, page 70, between ecclesiastical and civil authority did not find expression in any law to exclude clergymen from civil office. But public opinion on this matter is indicated by the fact that clergymen did not hold public office in the government of early Massachusetts. And there's many, many passages, but let me get into the basis of government on page 89. Well, it's just so excellent. Let me start on page 88. Williams agreed that political power came to the government from the people and that it was up to the people to measure it out to their rulers in a covenant that bound both parties. But he had his own ideas about the role of God in this process. The God of Roger Williams was a real and unmistakable God who did not enter into transactions of men in so light a manner as to be unperceived. If he had given political power to a group of people, there would be no mistaking the fact that he had done it. John Winthrop might persuade himself that God had sealed the covenant with Massachusetts simply by bringing a company of people safely across the Atlantic Ocean. Roger Williams could not. John Winthrop may see the hand of God offering him authority whenever the voters of Massachusetts cast their ballots for him. Roger Williams could not. And when Puritans talk of the divine right of kings, or of the peoples holding the powers of government in trust for the Almighty, Williams wanted to see the deed of gift. Where, when, and how, he wanted to know, did God transfer his powers to the people or anyone else? For that matter, when and where and how did God take any people since the Jews into covenant with him? If he did so momentous a thing, he would scarcely leave the people unaware of it. It would not require a speech by John Winthrop to make the fact known. To read the presence of God into human transaction was blasphemous. To claim a divine origin for any government was to be guilty of the same presumption that the Quaker has shown in calling their inner light the voice of God, and that Puritan showed in assuming that God stood behind churches he had never authorized and ministers he had never called. To Williams, the Bible clearly revealed that God established his church and ministry through Christ, and that Christ continued it through the apostles and evangelists. There had to be visible, temporal, specific transfer of powers. An agreement of self-appointed saints could not make a church or a minister. Hear, hear. By contrast, an agreement of self-appointed subjects could make a government and could make rulers. With such an agreement, could not do what was to endow rulers with divine sanction or with powers that belonged to God. Williams acknowledged that God approved of government in the same way that he approved marriage and disapproved of adultery. civil government was a good thing. Williams would not have wished to live without it, but it had no access to divinity it originated in and gained its powers from the people, and the people could not convey to it any powers they did not themselves possess. Emphatically absent from many powers possessed by the people was the capacity to start churches. And if they could not start churches, they could scarcely claim a right to control them. Therefore, they could not delegate such control to rulers. In denying government authority over religion or churches, Williams marched in the direction that few Englishmen or Americans, not to speak of Europeans, would be ready to follow for a century or more. The early separatists had edged towards freeing the church from state control when they insisted that Christians must not await orders or permission from civil rulers before reforming their churches. Reformation without tarrying for any meant without waiting for the civil governments. But in spite of Robert Brown's arousing slogan, the separatists had actually believed that the state ought to control religion, that the government ought to require everybody who worshiped to worship the way the separatists did. It was only when the government failed in its custodial role that Christians must act without it. But for Williams, the government had no business with the church at all. Williams seemed to have reached his conclusion in some intuitive way before he had fully articulated the premises that underlay it. As early as April 1631, Winthrop reported Williams' opinion that a magistrate might not punish a breach of the first table, the first four commandments, which concern religion. But Williams was not ready to write on the subject until he went to England in 1643, and explaining and defending his political convictions in the tracts he published there. Williams did not feel obliged to defend his basic assumption that government originates in an agreement, a covenant of the people, for this was an accepted idea. But in evicting God from proceedings, he took a step that all but incomprehensible to his contemporaries, and a little too easily comprehensible to his 19th and 20th centuries descendants. At the root of his reasoning, another of the many starting points that led Williams to the same vision of a proper state, lay a novel reading of history, which, like his other intellectual novelists, rested on widely accepted assumptions. From the time of the Church Fathers, Christian theologians had made it their task to reconcile the events of the Old Testament with those of the New. Out of their efforts developed a branch of theology known as typology, devoted to discovering in history of Israel certain person events and episodes that somehow prefigured the life of Christ. For example, Joseph's descendant into the pit and Jonah's into the belly of the whale prefigured Christ's descent into hell. Solomon prefigured the Church of Christ. In typological terms, Joseph and Jonah were types of Christ, and Christ was the antitype of Joseph and Jonah. The temple was the type of the church, and the church was the antitype of the temple. With the coming of Christ, the events recorded in the Old Testament required or retain their significance as type for the instruction of future generation of Christians. But some, at least, of the literal significance of many of those events departed. Christians were called upon to imitate not Joseph or Jonah, but Christ. Christ thus wrought a break in the continuity of history that could be bridged only by deciphering the symbolism of the history that preceded him. Not everything in the Old Testament was typological. The Ten Commandments, for example, were as literally significant and binding for Christians as they had been for Jews. All right, so then there were differences, all right, between them. All right, let's go on to, so this is important to know. Because we're talking the basis of government, if it is Torah or Christological or civil or whatever. Let's go on to, and this is pretty interesting, I believe, in fact, of this whole, and since at this time Israel was not a nation, and now God has reconvened the nation of Israel, what does that mean? Okay, how does that look in our day and age? Let's go on to, this thing about who, page 93, all right. Well, I'm going to go to page 92 because it's worth, worth reading. It was futile and wrong for civil rulers to learn from Israel because Israel could have no modern counterpart. William agreed with other Puritan Protestants that Israel had been a nation specifically favored by God and that in Israel had combined state and church in a single holy institution. But Williams believed that with the coming of Christ, God had dissolved the combination, that to accomplish the dissolution was in fact one of his purposes in sending Christ into the world. In examining the consequences of incarnation, Williams found that the Jewish church ceased to be the church of God. The Jews became an ordinary nation on par with other nations, and the Israel of the Old Testament assumed a purely typological significance. The ecclesiastical function of Israel is passed on to spiritual associations, to a group of believers who gathered to worship God and his Son, wholly unconnected with civil government. These early Christian churches had their successors was the antitype of Israel. And in the antitype of the temporal powers of the old church state of Israel were transformed into purely spiritual powers. The only sword Christ allowed, okay, I'm going to go on, was, and this is their view, was his sword coming out of his mouth. The church's only power was the power of the word. Since Christian churches must not have temporal power, and civil states must they combine, church state composed of Christian was impossibility. And Israel's a church state could have no literal significance for man in the Christian era. And typologically itself, and not merely its temple, was the Old Testament prefiguration of the New Testament of church of Christ. Now this has changed since Israel has become a nation. This was in, you know, the 1600s. The implications of William's typological interpretation were far-reaching, especially for civil government, and it led to replacement theology in the modern day, because so many misguided magistrates sought instruction where there was none to be had. The devotion of New Englanders to the example of Israel was the great obstacle that prevented them from discerning the true functions of government. To take Israel as a model for the state, the way the leaders of Massachusetts did that, was to haul down Christ and to restore Moses. In the opening of The Bloody Tenet, Yet More Bloody, Williams explained that the basis of all his reasoning lay in two propositions. First, that the people, the origin of all free power and government, are not invested with power from Christ, Jesus, to rule as wife or church, to keep it pure, to punish opposites by the force of armies, etc. Secondly, the pattern of the national Church of Israel was a non-such intimate way by, okay, excuse me. Secondly, the pattern of the National Church of Israel was a non-such unimitable by any civil state in all or any of the nations of the world beside it. The two propositions, and this is a problem we find now, were closely related. Israel was unique in the history of the world and unimitable. Williams believed because while God had for a time and place both his government and his religion on earth in the safekeeping of the people of Israel, he never again entered into any covenant with any nation. No subsequent government had his sponsorship. None was authorized to act in his behalf. Since the coming of Christ, the only way God had contracted with men except as individuals was through the churches of Christ, which were scattered throughout the nations and were forbidden by their founder to propagate or defend his religion by force. Okay, so Moses could not wield the sword for God with righteousness. Israel could send forth its armies to smite the heathen, but nobody of men who now implore force in the defense of religion, whether at home or abroad, could claim the name of Christian. Force could be successfully exercised in religion only in support of false unchristian religions. Any religion that could benefit from the use of force was by definition not Christian. But since the Holocaust and World War I and II, we have found, as the Bosnian Christians said concerning their Serb Muslims, is should I break two of God's commandments, lie and allow murder, or murder the perpetrator of the liar, the thief, and the murderer? So this has changed since the Holocaust, and Israel has become a nation. They did not follow that Christians need no governments. Governments there must be, and Christians must join other men in establishing them and submitting them. But no, so, and then it goes on. The bottom line is that the magistrates and the leaders of this government should be moral and, well, let me see what they say. What shocked Williams most about the position he opposed with his place subjects subjected Christ's holy church and religion to the whims of men, if he, as he and his opponents contended, magistrate received from the people an authority to establish true religion, it inevitably followed that a people, as a people, naturally considered of what nature or nation, soever in Europe, Asia, Africa, or America, have fundamentally and originally as men a power to govern the church, to see her duty to correct or to redress, reform, establish. And if this not to pull God and Christ in the spirit of heaven and subject them into natural, sinful, and constant men, and so consequently to Satan himself, by whom all peoples naturally are guided, let heaven and earth judge. Which happens when this happens, this scenario that he paints, when we have ungodly rulers, rulers who have no poor moral compass or who are under, as he says, the Satan. They are under the Satan. So this whole issue of is what is a covenant nation? A covenant is made with God makes the covenant with man, as he says. You cannot enter into covenant with God unless God initiates the covenant, because he's God. Government is, in fact, on page 127, the instrument by which the people became or remained civil. So civility seems to be closely associated with the rule of God, law, and was thus dependent on government. A government then protected civility by punishing scandalous offenders against the state. Their crimes presumably violated the laws that guarded the bodies and goods of men. For Williams had ruled out the government's guardianship of men's spiritual welfare. Evidently, however, he thought that the protection of bodies and goods required enforcement of precepts that we would describe as moral. The state said it must punish not only murder and theft, but also quarreliness and lasciviousness on all grounds that they threatened public safety. Right, that does not happen any longer. And on page 128, Williams says that humans could live together happily and peaceably in civility only by honoring the commands which their Creator had given them. And those commandments would be the moral codes delivered to Moses, 5 through 10, that God's revelation of law of nature and the law, moral and civil, that there is a universal standard. As it says in Romans, the conscience of man, the natural law, that you've been given a natural conscience, unless it's been severed through your continual denying of that and denying of the Father Creator and his servant Jesus. So there is a very active separating religion from government. Williams makes a moral virtue a qualification for holding office, and by implication, the establishment of morality, a function of government, provided government pays due respect to men's consciousness. And I'm going to leave it there. Except for this last, his conclusion would set in part the separation of church and state. It requires, on page 140, a vigilance and impartiality that were rare among rulers to watch over the exercise of religion in such a way as to prevent one group within the state from usurping authority over the consciousness of other groups. Parliament had failed to learn that one religious belief could be favored above another only at the expense of truth. The Christian magistrate could best advance the cause of his own religion by doing it no favors. This was in conclusion. Of course, it opened up a lot of the issues of the morals and ethics of a ruler or a nation and the civil body politic of the government. This is my final statement in this segment of the crucible of the judgments and practice and statutes of, like I said in 1 Samuel 12, that if there is a king and we do have judges and magistrates and lawyers, they must abide by the laws and commandments of the Father Creator that are elaborated in the Holy Word of God, the Old and the New Testament. God bless you.